Anyway, we're going to start. Liz just wanted to share some information.
So, good morning, everybody. What's coming around, there has been just a question raised amongst regents about maximizing their, decreasing their travel time and maximizing their meeting time. And I just wanted you to have as a point of information for this committee, since we have so many newer committee members, the Academic and Student Affairs master calendar schedule that we use to make sure that we are meeting our responsibilities for preparing the program review reports and for institutions to know on what cycle programs will be and so on. And a part of the reason that I provided this is right in the middle of the column is the ASAC meeting, which is the meeting that we do largely by phone. So it's the off-month meeting of the Academic and Student Affairs Committee, where we preview items, have some discussion, do our program reviews, and so on. And so you can see what the commitment times are there. But what I also wanted you to see is on the very right-hand side of that schedule is the kind of guiding thing that we use in order to get all the various steps in place and consistent from month to month. So on the 25th of every month, we have proposals due on so on and so forth. So that you can see that if there's going to be continued discussion about how to change meeting times of regents, it'll wreak havoc with this. Can we do it differently? We can. But I just wanted you to understand how tightly this is scheduled, and I believe the institutions would tell you that it really has helped to have this very consistent schedule. Everybody knows, their campuses know, and so on and so forth. So if there's additional discussion about changing different committee meetings, we'll have to think about how that might impact this. So I just wanted you to have that, because I knew that was a topic of conversation. I can certainly appreciate why regents are trying to keep their committee meetings on one day if they have to come to Salt Lake that are off-board meeting times. But I wanted you to have some basis for understanding how we have organized this date-wise and due date-wise. So that's
thank you.
That.
Thank you. And I'm glad you brought up the meeting that we hold before this meeting, because sometimes I think in this meeting we just kind of go through stuff and everybody doesn't realize that we've had discussion about this at a previous time and given our offers and suggestions on different things that actually change from the time of our meeting until here. So just wanted to say that. So let's start with our first action item, which is the revision of policy R-165 and current enrollment. And I'll turn to Liz for
me. Yes. So House Bill 237, Concurrent Enrollment Enhancements 2018, called upon us to establish a policy describing the required qualifications for an individual to be an eligible instructor for a concurrent enrollment course. And that is, in fact, what the policy language says, and we've worked diligently through our various groups of people that this would impact to draft language about concurrent enrollment instructor qualifications, and you can see what we've done in here. The problem that we thought we were trying to solve was that occasionally on-campus department instructors were held to one standard and concurrent enrollment instructors to a different standard, and we wanted to be sure that in those cases where that wasn't being followed, there was policy that says it has to be followed. So we understood that that was the impetus for the bill, and that's what we've been working on. In the last week, we have had some conversation with Representative Winder, who said that it was not institution by institution that the concern was, but statewide. And so we've, as we had conversations with him, that isn't exactly what the statute says, I might say, but that was his intent. So we'll, the discussion we had said, let's put this through. This is solving one problem we know we have. And then we'll have conversation between now and March to try to address the concern that he raised relative to a more statewide consistency of concurrent enrollment instruction qualification. So.
Any comments or questions about this?
This isn't really about this, but just as maybe a unintended consequence. I think there's another bill that's being considered around a concurrent enrollment and the expansion into 9th and 10th.
There is.
And we've been asked to comment on that. And one of the issues that we'll have when this is verified and confirmed is finding qualified faculty to actually accommodate that growth. And this, my sense is, from what we're what I'm hearing from my concurrent enrollment people, is we can't grow it because there aren't faculty to do it. So just, it's kind of a, they're just kind of interplay there. That
aside from, I mean, as we go through the legislative session, I'm sure a number of different things about that particular legislation will come up and be considered, but. Amongst the chief academic officers who met yesterday, one of the concerns is, really, these are college-level courses, and we're having ninth graders take them?
So there is still, we currently have an exception for ninth and tenth graders. To me, that's exactly what you sound like. I mean, there's no need to change this to all or elevate. There's somebody out there that can really do it.
Well, I think some of our charter schools, those ones that are with college, I think they probably use that. You know, the early college.
No, they actually, INTEC only allows, they've got it very clear, it's only juniors. They do not want their 9th and 10th graders in college level classes. So the juniors have to get an exception.
I know one thing, I brought this up at our committee meeting on 6.4. I think sometimes we hear, you know, people say, oh, I'm going to take it in high school because it's easier than if I take it at college. And I really like the addition at 6.4 where it says that the curriculum standards and the exams, if possible, should be used the same ones that are used on the college level. And I think that's just a great thing. I think then that, you know, kind of gets away from that some people think that, oh, take it in high school, it's easier. Yeah. So I think that's a really good, I personally really like that addition. So I don't know if anybody has anything else to bring up about this. If not,
go ahead. I have one modest suggestion. My lawyering got the best of me on 10.1. James there, which says, once approved as an adjunct, concurrent enrollment instructors may continue to teach concurrent enrollment courses given curricular standards and student performance outcomes in the classes meet sponsoring academic department standards. I think that word given should be provided.
Should be provided.
Oh.
Yeah, I think.
That's good. That's a really good catch.
That's a different word.
Yeah.
That's more colloquial in a sense, but anyway, provided I think clarifies that.
Easily done.
Mm-hmm. If there's nothing else, I'll look for a motion to accept the changes with the change, including the change that Regent Jensen suggested. So, do we have a motion for that?
I move. For what you just said. with the changes.
There's a second. Thanks. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. All right, let's move on. This one we've kind of pushed around a little bit for our mental health recommendations, and we've worked with this a lot and had a lot of discussions on this and made changes. And so what's in your materials is the latest that we have after getting input from institutions, getting input from regents, getting input from everything. So I don't know if you want to, I don't know that we need to take the time to go through all these changes. We've talked about them a lot. But is there anything that anybody wants to bring up about this before we approve the mental health recommendations?
I would like to bring up something.
Sure.
We know that this is a growing problem on our campuses. And at this point, we're not doing anything system-wide to request funding. And that's a concern to me. And I'm just going to use words that this is an unfunded mandate, and it's even more than that. I would use the word crisis on our campuses. We were reported, where's Brad? Is Brad over there?
Yeah, he's right there.
Oh, there you are. Brad, I guess Madon shared at the CAO meeting yesterday some really concerning statistics. We have concerning statistics, et cetera, et cetera. So the system, I feel, I'm just really strong. It would be so helpful if the system could develop a priority of funding and how we do that. Our students had last year did a new fee. It was $10. They're upping that this year at $10. And we did 0.5% tuition increase. But I would love to see as a system, you know, really, I mean, people need to understand. And then it comes into, again, a critical shortage of people with, you know, backgrounds in how to help people with mental health issues. Brad, maybe you want to.
Well, I think probably the statistic that John shared is that in the Oxygen survey, I love to say Oxygen, we had, it showed 2% of our students that attempted suicide in the last 12 months.
2%, really?
Yeah, which is over 500 students. It's a serious issue. We know that we cannot hire enough counselors to get ourselves out of the problem, so we're trying to take and our counseling services staff are some of the most creative, innovative people on campus. And we've started classes to help prepare us peer-to-peer student mentors and counseling. We're doing a lot of group sessions for the fall semester when all the appointments are gone on November 15th before you hit the critical, stressful time of the semester. It is a real concern, and but we're trying to make do as best we can. We have some money tucked into our budget requests to help deal with it, but yeah, having a highlighted assistant would be helpful.
500 students is how many counselors do you have? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dakota.
Yeah, so I think that students are usually about half a step ahead of everybody else. They started talking about mental health in 2015 as their student initiative from Utah Student Association. So this has been a conversation, and just because they've moved away from focusing strictly on mental health, it's actually because they've noticed that mental health is part of campus safety, including and encompassing all of the other factors with everything from sexual assault, sexual harassment, as well as physical campus safety as well. And so that's why that is their initiative this year, is because mental health hasn't, this conversation is still a problem. It is still an epidemic on all of our campuses, and it's only getting worse, and now the conversation has gotten bigger to this overall conversation of campus safety. When the students got together, they push initiatives on the Hill, right? So we have an entire day next week that we're doing a training up at Utah State, actually, training our student body presidents to be able to lobby legislators for the things that they need and to have student representation on the Hill. When they were going through our budget, I pulled out anything from each institution that related to campus safety or mental health, and I highlighted it from our overall region's budget. And the really sad thing is that there's some pieces in there from individual institutions, but it's not this overall, like, let's just go rah-rah the legislature to talk about why this is such a problem. And so I mentioned to them, you know, if legislators aren't talking about it, if the system isn't talking about it, then your job is to talk about it and to make a resolution on the floor to send it out to all of you as presidents, as well as the Regent community, the Regents, and the Utah System of Higher Education community, that this is a problem. And it's not just one campus. It is all of our campuses. It is all of our students. You have 184,000 plus students asking for our help in this specific regard.
So I think just beating on that, that won't look particularly good that the students had to come and bring us.
I'm very apologetic to be late into the room and then jump right in. So correct me if I'm going the wrong direction. Yesterday, Jason Perry and I spent several hours visiting with legislators, and some of this topic came up in a little different way. But if we want to listen to kind of what they're saying, maybe that would be wise. Because what they're saying is, it seems really inefficient to us that you're each doing this work independently. And what could be gained with a collective view of more information sharing on safety, more collaboration on mental health? Now, some of that will be sensible and some of it won't work very well because we're talking about individual people that live in certain places. But I do think there's probably a message in there about a collective. We are making very significant investments in campus safety. We're doing it through reallocation of dollars. We are not expecting to go and ask the legislature for those dollars. And I don't think it would have been a good strategy for us to do that. The timing was also problematic for us. But I do think there's a strategy in here about listening to what they're saying, which is, could you work together in some collective to be more effective? Maybe it's sharing effective service models, because we're all having to do this differently. Individual counselor appointments is not going to get it done. Peer counselors, group sessions, quick response. There's new ways that we have to do this work. We probably should be doing that in some way together. Probably what we are learning painfully about campus safety, we ought to be sharing that with everybody and what we're doing and how we're doing it in the spirit of reducing the likelihood that these things happen on other campuses. So, you know, I just want to say I think there's a drive for, could you do this together better than you can each do it alone?
Teresa, can I just echo that? Because I was in a meeting, the Governor's Excellent in Education Committee, and Senator Milner, this was her big push. We're talking about K-12 and what they're doing on campus safety. And she posed the question directly to us, what's USHI doing as a system? So I think this is really a brewing where, as a system, we've got to look at some solutions and share our best practices in state.
I think it's important that we do things together and share together, but I also think it's important that we don't do everything together. You know, it's that sort of federated model that allows you to adjust to the local circumstances.
Sure.
Campuses throughout the whole state are very different from each other, and their communities are very different from each other. But certainly, there are things that we can share and do more effectively by coordinating and learning from one another. I think we ought to be careful to balance those things appropriately.
So just to Ruth's point, I think, and Jeff's as well, I think we have one good example of a collaboration that did actually work pretty well, which was Safe UT. Mm-hmm. And we heard some reports yesterday about how powerful that tool has been on some of our campuses and how students are using it. So I agree with you know, plain vanilla for everybody doesn't always work, but some things where we can do a collaboration really can support each other in resolving this problem or at least addressing it.
When you talk about resolving the problem, some of you might have read it too. I read an article and it just talked about, it just showed graphs about social media and middle school kids, and they showed the difference of the mental health challenges. It's just unbelievable. And social media is not going to go less. And so I don't think this problem, it's only going to keep getting worse because of what's happening in our middle school, in the middle school years of our students. So, this is a situation not only for higher ed, but it's a situation for K-12, for sure. So
I want to underscore that because we've been with our K-16 partners and superintendents and principals. There's a pandemic that's getting. And so I think one of the other things about being sort of bifurcated or balkanized and course, I guess, you know, even though we were talking about having this sort of a state strategy, we aren't acting like it, you know, in terms of the state. This is not just higher ed, and it's not just K-12, it really is a state thing. So we got to be working together, not just a system, but how do we extend across into K-12 partners to start early, especially on mental health education and wellness. And it just seems like we might be focusing on the triage and treatment. We got to get this prevention down.
Right, and you know, the K-12 is actually revising their health curriculum right now, and it hasn't been done for years. I was chair of that committee for years, but they have mental health in every grade now in their standards. And so I agree with you that they do. And our Northern Utah, K-16 Northern Utah Alliance, we actually dealt two meetings with mental health. So I think that's it is.
Just a question, and maybe Kyle, our CSAOs, has there been any conversation? And I know the CSAOs have been very involved in helping craft this language and make it a little easier to implement, et cetera, but I don't know whether there's been any conversation about what President Watkins talks about in terms of a collective effort and joining forces. And I guess I feel like we ought to be more assertive in terms of how do we do this and actually task to come up with ways that we can work together, leverage resources.
Well, we had that group. We had the mental health group that actually started all this, and I wonder why that, maybe we shouldn't stop that, because it actually involved
statewide.
It was a good group. It involved.
That's a really good point.
It involved K-12. It also involved other agencies, and anyway, we should really consider that, Liz, that maybe that committee doesn't.
It was well represented across the
but
state. But I think that would be.
We could look at those members and decide.
And have that re-engaged, yeah.
I think that might be a really good
idea. Ended
so we did,
yeah,
and we dissolved the committee just a couple months ago after they came back with these recommendations. Chair Jones, Regent Jones, Chair.
I think it was last spring, and we met a lot of time.
But it was very collaborative. It was well represented across the state. We worked on it for about a year. We really pushed hard to actually get the committee and to do the work.
So
but
you know what?
Let's do that.
I think that can help with what President Watkins suggested. That we just continue that. So
make sure
a more narrow charge around collaboration and leveraging resources.
Right. Because what we were trying to do was come up with
a recommendation. That's a great suggestion.
Thank you. Okay.
I do think the President Heffelman's question about this, the recent CSA conversations around this, if that group reconvenes, there's almost sort of subcharges within the larger charge. Mm-hmm. Right? There is a subcharge for all of the heads of our student health services, our mental health services, to really be more tighter in coordination and collaboration. Mm-hmm. There's a subcharge of K-12, K-16 sort of communication. There's a subcharge over here. Now, when that group, I think the Regents group was convened, there was a feeling, quite honestly, from the CSAOs, there was a feeling that that group was constructed and then mandated a bunch of things without consulting perhaps the folks on the ground that were actually implementing a number of things. So, and again, I'm just reflecting what the conversation was. I think if we do reconvene this group, we need to have the folks that are the ones on the front lines informing what these sort of subcharges are for this larger group, this larger conversation. I mean, when our today you'll hear a report from President Tumines about the state of affairs with mental health at UVU, and we just had a trustees report from our director Bill Irva at our most recent trustees meeting, talking about just the increasing percentage of students that we're receiving into the system, into UVU, walking in the front doors of UVU. Already from the K-12, bringing,
That's what the article I read said. When they enter higher ed there.
And so right now, as the conversation shifts, and as Jeff mentioned, this sort of approach of better coordination, but also the unique needs. At the most recent mental health higher education symposium about a week ago, there was this discussion of, yes, you can achieve a few efficiencies, But at the end of the day, this is a personal interaction service that you cannot just say, oh, that ratio, let's just keep getting that ratio up and up because we can gain efficiencies through technology and frontline services. These are going to be people-heavy services that we just have to invest in at some level, even while we get more efficiencies from coordination. So it is both and.
You know, is there angst about approving this? It seems like what's here, that we need those surveys, we need, but we also need more discussion. Is that, are we okay with that?
I guess I think it's like, we just started.
Okay.
And we want to send that message. This isn't, you know,
this isn't
check
yet.
That
yeah.
box. Yeah. And I think maybe it, you know, is somehow that statement can be attached to it, right?
Okay. Yeah. All right. Commissioner, we're kind of going to ask that the committee be reconvened and maybe have some additional members. Okay. So, is there a motion to approve this as it stands right now? Not very many of us that could make that.
Well, I'll make that motion, but I really like the idea that I'm hearing of that we reconvene or expand that committee to continue the work.
So could be part of your motion.
So I would, with that recommendation, and I think expand it. We did have representation. We had two campuses. The group was quite large, so we did. We had presidents on the committee, but I think that's really a great.
Well, and maybe it's one of those things where we're asking each institution, one or two people that they would like to be involved in the committee. But I think maybe we can let the institutions determine who they wanted to be there.
And we had legislators, so it was really broad, which was great. But, so that would be my motion.
The committee can come up with that recommendation. Mm-hmm. Just, that would be great. All right, so you're going to make that motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Thanks, Marlon. So, I can always look to Marlon
first. We all can.
So, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much. This has gone on a long time, and it's going to continue to go on for a long, long time, unfortunately. All right. I'm very excited. We have our annual report coming up, and Blair, did you want to start that before you turn the time over to it?
Well, actually, I think in interest of time, why don't we just go directly to our distinguished guest here, John Sutherland.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So this was kind of an off year for us. It wasn't this last legislative session. We didn't ask for money, but so let me just review some of the highlights, and I'd certainly be willing to answer questions. We have now achieved tripling of the number of computer science graduates in the state since the beginning of this initiative. We've doubled the number of engineering graduates. I think that's great. Every time we go ask for more money, we reset the baseline, and we promise a certain number of graduates if they give us a certain amount of money. This last time, in 2017, the legislature appropriated $4 million, and we promised 320 new graduates with that, and we grew by 345 graduates, 11% or so over those 2 years. And so this next session, we're planning to go back, and just like we did last time, we asked for $5 million. We're going to ask for $5 million this time. You never know what you're going to get out of the legislature, if you will get any money at all, but that's what the request will be. There's some good information here about the fact that we're constantly checking that the institutions have been matching the funds as required by statute. I think it's also interesting that we've reached $19 million in ongoing funds, so when that's all matched, that's an additional $38 million a year that's now being put into this, into engineering, which, you know, given the fact that places like University of Utah, the number of kids choosing engineering and computer sciences from the incoming freshman class has grown from 7% to 20%. You know, we've definitely needed that growth and capacity in engineering, both for the students and to support the Utah economy. In here, there's some detail about the kinds of faculty that were hired with the last set of funds that were appropriated. The legislature put in intent language which said that the money had to go to the high demand fields, and so that's what we did. We think we went through and found the highest demand, both by using a couple of government studies, and we approved basically all the funding that was requested for by all the institutions, so faculty in computer science, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, and civil engineering. And so I think that went pretty well the last time we went through and did that. Yeah, we had the $4 million, how it's split out, and the match is all called out here in this report that I hope you all have. It's been a great initiative over 18 or so years. It's making a big difference in our state's economy, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to present to you and to be a participant in this and see this kind of results happen over the years. So, and are there any questions for me? I'd be happy to answer. Oh, the presidents, I think, are on board with supporting another request, although it does get painful for them to come up with the matching funds. So, you know, we appreciate their support. We always ask ahead of time. But they seem to be supportive, even though it's not officially in their priorities that we'll go to higher ed for those requests.
Well, we really appreciate your service. It's like you've done this a long time. Thank you for this.
I've gotten really gray over those.
I do actually have a question. I actually thought you were waiting here for the request. I didn't realize you were coming every, like, I thought it was going to be 3 years, not 1 year gap and then forward. And the reason I bring this up, this would be the one thing that as president I need to know, is a longer plan, schedule, because it does the matching funds, what we do with our workforce requests in the new SHE budget, et cetera, should be, I think the scrutiny that the new SHE budget gives, we've got to be on something.
Well, Dave and I have talked about just a little while ago about coordinating this better. One of the challenges has been timing. I mean, we don't want to go back to the legislature until we know we've achieved the results that we promised them. And we don't know that until the end of October, and the higher ed budget gets set by August, I think. So there's a timing problem here, and so we do need to do a better job of giving you a heads up that this might be a year that we go back to funding. We just don't have the data until well past when that budget is set. And as far as a longer term view, it seems that's an interesting request, and I can see why you would say that, but we go kind of on a demand basis, right? Right now, the state is screaming for more engineers and more computer scientists to fill thousands of positions that go unfilled. And UTC and some of their membership, Utah Technology Council, would like to see us go for huge requests and massively grow the system for graduating. And I don't believe that we can make that kind of step function in higher ed, where we've got tenured faculty and you have to grow programs and you have to find space. So I think this incremental approach has worked and should continue to work well, right? But
again, what could happen is the legislature could say, well, we'll give you this much. What are you going to give and take on? So I don't know what to do about this August versus October, but this really has created a dilemma for Utah State, because I did not include these things in my workforce budget because for some reason, probably because I don't pay attention sometimes, I thought it wasn't going to be till next year. What do you say?
But I just want to, and maybe this is easier for us, we just opted out this year because we said we can't connect the matching funds. So I don't know politically as a university whether you can do that. Maybe it's easier for us.
What does that mean?
We're not asking.
What happens once the legislature appropriates money is that we work with each of the institutions to get requests from their,
Just
say you're not going to submit a request. We haven't submitted one yet because we haven't asked for one yet.
Yeah. I think that's an option.
So John and I did meet after we learned that they were asking for this request, and of course we're interested in getting whatever we can to help build our workforce, even though it wasn't in our request. But we did want to see if we can coordinate better on the front end and the back end. Okay, so we, and John has explained why we all traditionally missed on the front end, but I think that we committed with each other that we're going to communicate better on the front end. Maybe you won't have the final numbers, but we may have some preliminary idea or, you know, something that we can at least project.
Right.
And so that we can just communicate. We're friends and allies, but, you know, right now it's been kind of, we're going this way, and then, oh, here comes this, and we didn't really you know, we didn't know it was coming, and even in the president's workforce request, there's some things that are kind of similar to the engineering initiative, not totally, and so, but then also on the back end, because now I'm hoping this is your remembrance of this, too, so I'm not going to put it in writing or sign a blood oath or anything, but that even on the back end, if you get funded to elevate, you know, the discussion above the engineering deans, and to, so that provost and presidents have a say before the TIAB makes their recommendation. Because right. even though it is only a recommendation to the Board of Regents, traditionally they are very reluctant to mess with that because this has come from a statutory group that includes business and industry leaders. And while the Regents could change it, it's challenging to change it.
It's been changed once.
It's been changed once in how many years? I think that was fairly minor.
Yes. So another thing that we talked about doing on the back end is, and maybe you aren't all aware of this, but by statute, the money that has to be matched is the money that goes to faculty lines. And their money can be used for things other than faculty lines, but one of the challenges there is convincing the TIAP members that we're getting growth in graduates if we fund counselors or if we fund, you know, outreach programs or things like that. So we want to have another back-end discussion with the board members about, you know, help us understand the broader perspective of what will really help grow engineering graduates beyond, you know, just funding faculty.
And I felt very confident when you told me that. I've heard from someone on my staff that is not the case, but I have not communicated that back to you. So Jeff is sitting right here. Jeff, would you put that on your to-do list? Let's track down what is the required match, because that would be helpful to institutions if it's only for the faculty lines and not for the other. But,
I read the statute.
Okay, all right. I haven't read it myself. I just didn't tell you.
That would actually be tremendously helpful.
I've had conflicting. Yeah.
So
let's just make sure and nail that down.
And I'm sorry to surprise you. We don't mean to do that. There's just this huge pressure in the industry to get more and more graduates in these fields because it's the job openings and it's important to the economic growth of the state. And so when we reach that goal and find out that we've grown by the amount we promised, then we get a lot of industry desire to go forward and ask for more.
Well, again, we also get workforce needs from other areas. And I would be totally pumped if this was an additional increase to the USU budget. Then we'd all be happy. What has happened in the past, though, is offsets. And I hope it isn't this year. I hope it can be additional, and we will see.
It's kind of hard to tell whether there's offsets or
additional. Yeah, but we have seen.
Well, I would want to say good things have happened through this initiative, yes. And we are grateful for it. When
Absolutely.
You look at the grads, it has supported a lot of positive growth. We understand there's some tension, and we get it. It's, you know, a lot of growth creates some challenges. We got to figure it out. One of the ways that we manage that is that we don't always spend money that has been allocated at the exact rate we think we're going to. And some of that is when you're making faculty offers and hires, you don't actually know who's going to say yes and who's going to come. And so you do have some controls about the gating of the way resources go out and your match. As far as we've implemented, I hope it's okay to say this out loud, because you know, you're trying to recruit the best people you can. They don't all always say yes when you think they will. So that's one strategy that you can implement to control when your commitment happens on the match too. And then I think some clarity, because of course our engineering deans have a very strong incentive to grow their faculty, and they're gonna push on that. But if in fact it is a lot, because every time you add 100 students, you need the 200 or 300 students, you need to think about your advising corps and the supports that help them. So I think having some clarity together on that would be really helpful as well.
And I've started to hear from not just the administration, but from the deans that, you know, this idea of just pushing for more faculty by the TIAB, because that, in our mind, historically we've said that grows the factory, lets us produce more graduates, right?
Yeah.
You can't produce more if you don't have the faculty.
That's right.
But, you know, Rich Brown and others have been telling me that, you know, you're kind of tying our hands in another way because we don't have the advising we need
right.
in that could help more students graduate by getting the counseling and support.
Because we don't do much for people if we get them in the program and we don't get them through the program. So,
right.
Yeah.
So that's the message I think that we'll collaborate on and get the TIAB to understand that better.
This is a great discussion. I hate to do this because of time, but we really need to move on. But it sounds like to me that this is something that John's committee and council presidents and stuff maybe need to discuss a little more than just, it seems like there's something here that needs to, that probably can't happen in this meeting, but could happen in the future. So maybe commissioners take a note of that and make everybody, make this work for everybody because it is a good thing. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you for your time today.
Okay, let's, Commissioner's here. He's going to give us a very brief update on the Utah College acceptance letter. That there's some information that's happened that we just need to know as Regents what's happening.
Yes, and I had a good conversation with Vice Chair Barnes on this earlier this week. As a staff, we realized that, you'll all remember back in our retreat back in April and subsequent meetings, one of the ideas that we came up with and it came from the working groups was the idea of this college acceptance letter going to every high school graduate and their parents and so forth. We're very excited about it. Meanwhile, the college advising, the college access advisors came to the forefront, and these are a little bit, we just want to make, anyway, but the recommendation is that we wanted to give Regent direction because the Regents had directed the acceptance letter. We think that's still a good idea, but we think it makes sense to put that on hold right now while we're implementing the college advisory, college access advisors, so that we're not kind of sending two different messages, some are getting one, some are getting the other, and that it's coordinated, and that as good as the letter is, a person seems like that is even better. And maybe the letter would be in a different format or something than we originally thought. So anyway, I wanted to bring it back to this committee and just get your guidance and direction so that as a staff we're aligned with what the Regents are thinking. So that's it. I tried to make that clear. That's why it's on.
I guess I just wanted to make sure, since you guys chaired that particular committee, Chair Marlin and Christina.
I think it makes sense. I mean, we're trying to have all the stars aligned for the students, and I think to send out the letters at this point, they're not going to get that next week. We don't have it. So I think we
want
to get more
bang
for your
buck.
We need to have
really
aligned
and
together. So I think it makes sense.
I second Christine's
point. That's very helpful to us, just because we want to make sure that we're keeping harmony with the board's wishes.
I also expressed a little bit of concern about the committee's work because the Regents were really highly engaged in those three committees. I know on completion, we're so excited about what's happening with transfer, and that was one of our big pushes. So and hopefully workforce feels the same and a conversation with those folks.
Yes.
You good?
Yes.
All right. I promised Liz 30 minutes for the last one, so. I know we got one more. That's what I'm saying. So we're already going into our lunch hour.
You're not eating today.
No, we can go. Okay, so our third one is the Career Technical Education Annual Report. We get this. And I always find it very interesting. So, Blair, do you just want to share?
Yeah, thank you, Regent Tyer. And I don't want to impinge upon the time of my boss, so I'll be brief here. So at any rate, our institutions within the UC system continue to do very impressive work when it comes to career and technical education and getting students prepared for the workforce in very specific kinds of career opportunities. To that extent, every year we provide an accountability report, which is part of your packet here today. And this is similar to what you've seen in previous years, but just with the updated numbers. We have a kind of a measurement that we use in the CTE world. It's membership hours. And roughly speaking, that is the amount of time that a student engages in learning activities. It may not be directly in front of a faculty member, but where it's based on credit hours, it would be the assumed amount of time that a student spends in preparation for the courses, time in faculty members' labs, et cetera, et cetera. And so we calculate that there's about 2.2 million membership hours last year in CTE learning that occurred throughout the state, which is a phenomenal number. And when we look at that across the state, what that means, it's about 75% of all post-secondary CTE learning time across the state. Our friends with UTEC do about 25%. Salt Lake Community College gets the top mark there. They get about 27% of the state. And UVU does a great job. They're up at 20%, and then Weber State, Snow College, Southern Utah University. Who have I missed? I hope I haven't missed anyone. UVU gets about 20%. So at any rate, there's a lot of activity and a lot of good work that occurs throughout the state. What this means in terms of economic benefit to the state of Utah, we have this past year over 5,800 credentials that were awarded in CTE. Those are certificates and associate degrees. Over the last 3 years, there's been over 16,000 CTE credentials by UC institutions. Just the last year, these 5,800 credentials that were awarded to these students, that we put an economic multiplier into that, and our data people do a projection, kind of an ROI analysis. We anticipate that over a working career, that would generate $1.8 billion of added income for these people that have earned these credentials, and to the state of Utah, $258 million of additional tax revenue to the state. So these are impressive numbers, and it goes to speak to the value that career and technical education plays and the role that our UC institutions play. And so we like to highlight these kinds of numbers because it really is a time to celebrate. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Chair.
If you look on page 50 of your diligent board thing, I mean, if you've seen that, haven't seen that graph, you need to look at that graph. Because Salt Lake Community College, they do an amazing service to our state. And I don't know that we always give them the praise and recognition that we should. But
can I just underscore that point? Not that you don't give me that praise. That wasn't the point.
That's the first part of the last part.
But I do think this is a kind of, again, a systemic thing we have to wrestle with. Because Commissioner Buehler is going to be irritated with me, but we're wrestling right now because the performance metrics that we use to award financial gain do not include certificate and associate degree level jobs. DWS does not include that data. And we have evidence that our nurses and our computer science certificate holders and our diesel mechanics contribute to these and are getting jobs, but the DWS data doesn't account for that. So I just want you to know that sometimes, even though we're trying to do this, the reward mechanisms that the state relies on are flawed. And it becomes really problematic for an institution to invest in a lot of money and have great programs when we get no legislative love or money for it. So I just want to underscore that because we got to figure that out. We're trying to figure it out, and Dave's been wonderful about helping differentiate community college metrics. We're really struggling with it, but we have to pay attention to that.
Yes, and that's why I'll just underscore. That's why I'm sure all the regents have carefully read all of their materials for today. That's why on that workforce metric we pulled the community colleges out. Because it turned out the five-star jobs were almost all national.
That's what it is.
So we need to develop one with them that works for them.
Yeah. Well, I showed this graph to my husband, who's on the UTEC Board of Trustees, and it's so a community college does more than every institution. Well, anyway, I don't think we voice enough what we do. But anyway, thank you so much, Laura. Thank you so much for, well, and UVU, you do a lot too. I mean, that's a lot of career and technical education. Thank you so much. All right, Liz.
Go.
Here we go. She says she has really good stuff for us today, so I'm on the edge of my seat.
Yes, well, I'm so sorry I missed the in-person discussion around transfer and articulation in November, but I'm not sorry that I got to hold that little baby that I was branding, and I'm sorry that I prioritize that, but not now. However, as I prepared for today, and thanks to Julie, who did that November meeting and got the ball rolling, as I prepared for today, I actually previewed this presentation with the chief academic officers. And the more that we talked and the more that I thought about what's in this and what we're going to discuss today, the more I thought, okay, now we're starting to coalesce around some really important things that can make a big difference in terms of transfer and articulation. And what I'm going to suggest that you think about as a committee today is I'm going to give you a number of different suggestions for recommendations. Let's see whether any of them have legs. Then in our between now and March meeting, when we meet over the phone mostly, but sometimes face-to-face, let's see whether that coalesces even more, and then we might be in a place in March to put forward some recommendations to the entire board. So that's kind of the way I'm thinking about this. It may not go that way, depending on whether you think what I've pulled together here are things that you are excited about in the way that I am. So quickly today, I'm going to remind you of some of the data. We're going to talk about the state student identifier, which is what SSID stands for. We're going to talk about the transfer guide. We're going to provide some feedback on what we've learned on from students about their concerns. And then kind of throughout, you'll see some policy recommendations. So just quickly, a reminder that transfer credits appear on a transcript for a variety of reasons. And I didn't get a chance to add it here, but one more reason is American Council on Education transcript can also add transfer data to a student transcript. So lots of different places transfer credit comes from. It is not just, I went here, I took that course, and I put it over here. So as we're looking at data on this particular issue, we have to take into account where the sources of the credit are. There's a fair amount of transfer, so 30% of our students, and an interesting statistic that came out of the work from our IR staff was that 57% of the students who do transfer enroll full-time. So, you know, there's something there that's important about that. One of the things that, as we've talked about this issue as staff and in various conversations outside of our meetings, we realized that we have a lot of questions and we cannot answer all of those questions. Some of them we can kind of answer because we can hook data from the National Student Clearinghouse, we can do this, we can do that, but it's a lot of fussing around to try to figure out the answers to these questions, and we can't answer all of them in our current circumstance. We just don't have a way to do it. So trying to find out what the patterns are, trying to find out what the performance in this pre-transfer course is, and then post-transfer course, are they able to do the work in the next level course? We can get some of that data. What courses are most frequently requested for transfer and denied? We can do that institutionally, but not system-wide. What courses are most frequently repeated, and so on. So we have a whole bunch of questions that are, some of them okay to answer, and some really almost impossible to answer. And one of the things that we've been delving into kind of as an underlying question is about repeated courses on transfer. So when students transfer, are they repeating a course that they took at the last institution, which would be problematic because that means they've taken one more course and they paid tuition one more time and they have done that. So we're still looking at that as kind of a subset of one of the questions that we're doing. The good news is it's only 10% of repeated courses are taken after transferring, so it's not as big a problem as we thought. But it's still 10% are repeated after transfer, so we're going to keep that in our quiver of things that we're looking at. So let me move to the, are there questions?
Liz, so at that first you said only 10% after transfer, were those, do you know if it was to take a better grade once they transferred or if it's separate?
We've looked into that a little bit, but we have to get further into it to understand it completely. Joe Curtin's looked at it very carefully. I have not internalized all that he has found there, but one of our suppositions was that it was for better grade. So you take a course here, you didn't get the grade that you needed, so now you're repeating it for that. So Julie?
62% of the repeated courses were because the students had gotten a D or lower.
Okay. So
34% had gotten a passing grade, but it may not have been the grade that was required for prerequisite status. That part we don't know, but 62-ish percent had gotten a D or lower.
So that really doesn't, I guess what you're saying, Julie, is it's not really an issue. I mean, that would seem to make sense, right?
Yeah, it'd be different if they were taking it because the institution wasn't having it. That doesn't sound like that's what's happening. It's a GPA.
There are little pockets of places where we know that's happening. Math is one of them. So yesterday at the Chief Academic Officers, we were looking at the math grade cut scores. They're not the same. So,
that's a problem.
It's anywhere from a D minus to a C.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so, we'll look at that a little further. It's still a fairly small number of people. We were thinking, oh, it's going to be all math, and it's because we're trying to repeat, but it's not quite as, it didn't follow the hypothesis.
These are winding elective.
I mean, it's still, I mean, we hear this data, and it just doesn't go along with what we hear when we go to institutions. That's not what we hear.
That's a problem.
And so, I just wonder if what students are being told maybe could be having them be told in a different way, so it's just like we can't accept that credit. You know, maybe they're not understanding why.
Well, I think you've got a group now that you did find they weren't accepted by another institution.
You mean the transfer credit was not accepted? We know that happens,
Yeah, so are you going to show another category of those?
Or
you've shown us all that you can find.
I'm showing you all that we have right now. So we're still asking questions.
But I mean, because there's still students all the time, and I mean, we still hear all the time about the transfer issue, and so there's a different issue.
I think what the heart of the issue is not that the credits don't transfer.
Well, they transfer, they just don't count.
They count. They count as electives. They don't count. They count towards degree. They just don't count toward major.
So I actually was talking about this earlier today with my provost. USU has a business college. Well, let's use engineering, an engineering college. And we also have a tech engineering education program, okay? And so a student will go in the tech education program and take AutoCAD and drafting. And they'll say, well, those should transfer into the College of Engineering. No, because not for their major, because those are not required classes
for
within the College of Engineering. And the way we tell the difference is the prefix, right? If it's a TEE class, you cannot transfer that into meet the major requirements of MAE, ECE, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just true, it doesn't. Because an engineering program doesn't require a standalone AutoCAD class. It's a surprise to students, but it's the fact, right? And so the way we do this is through prefixes. Another real common is BUSN. UVU, what do you guys use for your non-accounting, for instance? Don't you have a different prefix too? For the non,
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I looked it up. And bars that don't transfer into the Huntsman School of Business, we use BUSN. And they're saying, well, I'm taking business courses. No, you're taking business equipment, you know, Excel spreadsheet, you know, et cetera. Yeah. So I think when what she's talking about is prefects matched across universities, right?
So if there's any truth about transfer, it is and articulating courses is extraordinarily complex. And part of the reason I think you hear so often from students is that it has been extraordinarily complex. And one of the ways that we can start to address that complexity is understanding where students are and what they're doing and where the trip-ups are, because you hear about it because there are trip-ups. So if I could move into this little part, this is part of our solution here.
Can I make a statement on what you said was absolutely right, that, you know, those courses don't transfer from one side to the other. I think the issues that we hear are not those.
Oh, no.
But what we are hearing about is what happens between high school and going into the U or Utah State or Weber State. The issues that we hear are going from Salt Lake Community College to your institution. It is not within the institution, because by the time students come to understand their major, they know what courses they need because their advisors have told them that you cannot take a BUS prefix credit and transfer it over. So that is not the transfer issue. The transfer issue is going from high school to a university, high school to SLIC. Actually, SLIC, I haven't heard bad things. So Denise, on that one, I have to say kudos to you. But what I do hear, and I can have Justin Harding's wife come and talk about it. She just went through, their son has gone to, this is personal conversation again, it is anecdotal. I know we can defend ourselves all day long, but legislature is not going to listen to our defense, because they hear from people like him. His son has AP credits, his son has concurrent enrollment, and his son has some GTE credits. She's having a nightmare going into the U. When I talked to Dave, Dave's comment was, you know, we can work through it, I can help him. But that is because Justin came and talked to me. Justin came and talked to Tammy. What about the rest of the population that faces that? And that is what, when I was talking to Senator Milner, she said, within your institution, it's your prerogative what you do, because that is your requirements. That's what the quality of the degree is all about.
That is, you know what, on these associates, CE, everyone understands, right, the problem with the new Century Scholars.
Yeah.
Okay, which the students just pile on 60 credits, but they're mostly Gen Ed. So again, we're not talking about that. Isn't your problem that when, and some of the provosts that have been around a little longer, I thought we realized that a lot of our 4-year degrees are requiring too many 3,000 level classes. Isn't that what it is?
So we have, we could get into all this detail. I'm not sure this is the group to be dealing with that, to tell you the truth. I understand the issues. We know there are issues. And we have talked through just a couple of solutions here. So one is actually understanding what's happening to students. And one of the strategies that we don't have in place is a state student identifier. In order to be able to track students from high school into our institutions and from institution to institution. So the law requires it. That's what this slide says. We haven't been doing it. The law requires it. This is your.
This law was passed about 12 years ago.
Yeah, and this is the FAA. The law requires it.
12 years.
And we acknowledge that there are things that have to be worked out in order to do it. But our chief academic officers yesterday said we got to do it.
We have to.
We've got to figure out. So yes, one comment that I did get back on this issue was that somehow the state student ID got attached to COVID. No idea how. And now it has become a student privacy issue. So if we are going to depend on this, you're not going to get much of a buy-in.
It got attached to what, Sanj?
Core curriculum. Lord knows how. But
core curriculum.
So now they are talking about student privacy, and they are talking about we cannot do that. So if we want to work on transfer, we have to rely on the applications that students are submitting that has the credits that they want to transfer from AP. They submit their AP scores. They submit their high school IDs, and this came from Tammy, by the way. This wasn't, I wasn't aware of it.
And Tammy's
like,
here.
How,
we might want to note that we have Tammy here.
Who
should be up here?
I think she just months. Left. So that's right. She might.
She's here. Tammy. Tammy's right there. Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, come on up.
So if we have to work with what we have rather than relying on something new that we
so,
have.
So we can't follow our
we can. We can.
Good luck.
I'm just the eternal optimist. We are going to be able to figure out how to do that part of it. I understand there are some issues there relative to student privacy, but and it might be that we have to rely on the student to tell us that number, but we can work through those issues. I'm just confident we can work through those issues. There's too much upside to being able to follow a student record, and we're just going to have to figure out how we get
but the
that.
Students give us the records when they apply to the university.
They tell us their lunch notes.
No, I'm talking about their grades. Their grades are there. Their AP scores are there. They're required to submit their AP transcripts along with their application. I mean, my kids crossed state boundaries, and I didn't have to fight for AP credit. It just showed up on their record.
So, Tammy, what was the issue that was being raised?
Oh, just the having the student ID, having a single student ID follow kids from high school to college. And Teresa was probably, we probably dealt with it at the same time on the State Board of Education. It's in the law, as you have pointed out, we should be doing it. Everyone wants to do that. The student privacy issue, there's this whole group of people and parents who have fought that so hard, and they've won. We've had to change quite a few things in public education, and to it's just going to be a political fight. It needs to happen, and one of the legislators that I think realizes this and would help us with it kind of used to be on the other side of that issue, and now he's realizing that if we're going to track expenditures of public tax dollars and find out where they're being most effective, we need to track these kids from the time they have any service, like a preschool, publicly funded preschool, then they need to have a number, and we need to track them so we can do longitudinal studies. So the issue is that there is a whole contingency, this whole group of people that are making it very difficult. And they have some legitimate issues on student privacy. They don't want a software company tracking, you know, which websites or where the clicks are because it's giving away data. But it's just very, very difficult. It needs to happen. It's going to take some...
If they have as many concerns with higher ed as public ed, just because of the age of
students. They just don't like having that number transfer somewhere else. They don't like the fact, a lot of them don't like even the student ID number in public ed. But it's the transferring it, then after that they're afraid that, here's a specific concern that they talk about, that if a child is in trouble at school, they've had some office discipline referrals, they've been expelled maybe, they're afraid that that will follow them for the rest of their life.
Which is what I was told in elementary school. It's going on in front of
the language, right? So they're afraid that will follow them, and when they get to college, it's going to be used against them. And so those are the kind of things, yeah, kind of profiling. And those are the kind of issues.
Why can't it be the same as happens now? Like, My son and his friends started a fire on accident. And so they had a record, and they were told, as soon as you get 18, it's gone.
Mine started one not on accident.
But why couldn't it be the same as that, where that kind of information, after so many years, it's gone? I mean, I think you can deal with
You can deal with all of them, Teresa, and you know the kind of conversations that have been had. So this is just, it's something that needs to happen, and it seems so easy that we should be doing it. It's very political in nature. So.
I do understand that. My recommendation that I'm putting forward is the losses that just happened.
Let's do it.
Regions could suggest in policy that we follow the state law, which is what we often do.
Yes.
So, you know, we have state law that says this. We have region policy that says that. We could do that. So that's one of the things that could be talked about at our between board meetings, to see whether there's legs behind that. You want to support that kind of recommendation. The upgraded transfer guide, just very quickly. We have had a transfer guide for some time. It's been what we call the Chevrolet model. It hasn't been very sophisticated because it didn't have money supporting it. The institutions chipped in, we have $60,000. But the newer models, and some of them are being used, like the U is using Transferology right now, have huge data capabilities. And so you can learn a lot about what students are looking for, what's happening relative to transfer, by using a more sophisticated transfer guide. It can show students directly on the web what transfers where, how, why, what the concerns are, and so on. And then it can provide data to us that would be really helpful in making sure that we're increasing the number of students transferring successfully with equivalent rather than elective credit. We can really help on that front end with this kind of thing. We have had some pre-RFP release vendor presentations. They're very positive. There's several that institutions use and that are very powerful and useful. We'll put out an RFP and take a look at what they propose to us. Part of the reason that we're putting out the RFP is we don't have a very good handle on cost, and we really kind of need to know what's it going to cost. Because we haven't identified a way to fund it. But if you don't know what it costs, we don't know what our strategies for funding are. So that is one of the other things that we could do. Regions could consider a policy that says, once we've gone through this whole process and we have one, institutions have to submit their data so that the thing works. Because if one institution doesn't submit data, it doesn't work. You asked us to follow up on problems affecting students, and we did several different strategies for that. We know that one of the major problems is that the program transfer level, general education, is generally working quite well. We know we have some issues relative to language in our own policy that's not quite consistent, which we can deal with. The R401 and the R470 don't deal with letters of completion in the same way, so we can do that. The students said that there was really a lack of knowledge on what their appeal options were if they got a determination on a transfer and they didn't think it was correct. So, recommendations are to continue to work on the major and pre-major pathways. We had a really robust discussion about this that Chief Academic Officers yesterday. Begin with the top enrolling, top transferring majors. That's where we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck, so let's spend our time on that. Recommendation two, assure alignment of general ed, associate degree, pre-major policy language, which I just talked about. One of the things that we do have on every one of our campuses is a student appeal process. I'm not sure that students think about that process as a way to get a transfer credit determination fixed. And in some cases, they aren't really designed for that. But we can design ones for that and make sure that they know what the process is to go through and make it much more clear to students how they do that, where they do that, where do they start if they think they've gotten a transfer credit determination that's incorrect. Instead of about halfway through the class saying, you know, I already had this class, why am I sitting in this class trying to figure out how to do that upfront better? So those are the things that I'm bringing to you that seem to be coalescing, and we could certainly consider those as you want to chair at the next meeting or at the in-between meeting.
Well, we can talk about that, but there's just one thing we've talked about a couple times, and I don't know if it's ever happened, but I think it would just be really nice if there was some website or some where we hear students say they have a frustration that they could send that information to thing, like, or that somebody at Snow College could work with a student and the student's really frustrated and they can send that somewhere so that we can look and see what's happening and look at each individual case rather than just keep saying everything's okay. Do you understand what I'm saying? Somewhere that they just can go and say, this is my problem. I do have a problem because we keep hearing.
So we do have that process in our office. Greg Benson is our ombudsperson.
If somebody tells me they have a problem, I would like to say, please send your story to here. I would just like that to happen so that.
And what happens when Greg gets he pushes it back to the institution and makes sure they get to the right place.
Well, I think it needs to. Okay. It can go back to the institution, but I think we need to know anyway. Go ahead.
There is appeals processes, right? And it goes back to faculty primarily to then reconsider that transfer piece. The way it's usually described to students is when the student's upset or when something happens that's wrong. This isn't uncommon, right? Like, you'll get a phone call, and a student, I did have this happen once, it is, happens at all institutions, where you'll get a phone call and a student goes, hey, I just transferred to your institution, and all of the credits on my transcript that you just transferred actually aren't even mine. And you go through and you go, oh, you're right, something happened and we missed that. We went through and transferred wrong credits. Because it is human error. There are people that go ahead and do that transfer, and sometimes there's mix-ups, right? So it's the students that call and say, hey, something's wrong here, and if there isn't something that happened on human error, that's when the appeals process is explained. However, it's complicated for the students. Another thing is we've talked about, AP credit doesn't transfer to institution. When a student graduates high school, the college board sends AP credit to that institution that they've applied for. Then we go ahead and process that and put it in. But when you transfer to another institution, it shows as transfer credit from a different institution. So if I was transferring from, for example, UVU to the U, on my UVU transcript, it says transfer credit, which means the student needs to call the college board and have them resend those AP credits now to the University of Utah. It takes 6 weeks. And no, the expedited shipping doesn't help. So there's barriers, right, to that. The other last barrier that I see students have is that a lot of our institutions have some sort of global engagement, global distinction of at least a course, right? Slick and the U do this fantastically. The University of Utah honors Salt Lake Community College global engagement credit, so that is a marked up on their general education. However, that's not at every institution. UVU, I know you require some sort of global distinction, but that doesn't transfer to other institutions. So if you all require one, my suggestion is get on board that you all agree that that is some sort of equality, or make it equal of some sort to have that be able to transfer.
You know, I think as we think about investing in the statewide college advisor network, the wisest thing we could do is say to people that are thinking of starting in point A but finishing in point B, that you not think about this as a sequential relationship, but you think about it as a simultaneous relationship. You're planning from the beginning so that you don't wind up earning 3 hours of Excel spreadsheet credit that isn't going to go to Utah State or the U. And so that right from the beginning, rather than sort of saying, you know, the college advisor network only does one thing, get you in that first door. Because that's where it kind of tends to go bad. You sort of have to be planning for your transfer right from the beginning.
You know what? We got students waiting for us to eat. So.
Can I just wonder where this conversation is going, because I have all sorts of other information about what our students are experiencing.
I know, we need to.
And I think there's a, I don't think it's going to be a guide or, I think those are going to be helpful tools, but I think in the long run, we're going to have to decide whether the regents want to have some transfer policies that institutions are bound to help portability. That's, because right now, it's faculty on faculty making fist bump deals. That's exactly what's going on. And some of them are codified, and some of them are not. Washington State, if you want to play, has an unbelievable transfer process. And they do it through a transfer council, they resource it, they have remarkable guides like Liz wants. We have to resource it at the system level and create not just pretty pictures of how it looks, but actual expectations between institutions of what will be portable. And that's the crux, because we're working like crazy with the U and we've made major gains, but we looked at 24 programs, only one is 50-50. Only one can a student do an associate's degree and go and only take 60 more hours and get done in 4 years. Only one out of 24. Wow. So it's so complex, Liz is right. Because they get elective credit, so everybody says, oh, well, they get elective credit, that's okay. Well, no, it's not. Now you have 60 more hours in your major. But it's because we don't have system definitions, we don't have system expectations. And that's not, I'm not seeing that as a recommendation, and I think we got it. I would recommend that we recommend that, and take it higher.
And I think that would actually be helpful to try to dial this up to sort of policy level.
Yes.
It will get us, we'll get more for it, because the way we've been trying to solve this is individual MOU program to program. And, you know, 120 programs later, we'll be having to start all over if we ever get there.
So can we work with you were going to say
I think we're on the same page, but I wanted to say when we toured and we went to SLIC with Jessica, that was what Jeff said, is it's really hard for institutions to solve a systematic problem. Yes. And so I think that's what this conversation is leading to. But we have work meetings, and so maybe our next work meeting, we need to have a real work meeting and invite, and maybe expand that
on this topic. We would really appreciate the information. We talked about it a little bit, but I dropped the ball on getting the information from you. But if we can share that information in the next meeting, that would be helpful, because here's my concern, and that is if we don't do it, it'll come from legislature, and then we are going to look like we don't do any work, even though we've been trying to do it.
Okay. You talking about our meeting?
But we have a work meeting with academic affairs, so maybe in a month.
If we have that, we really should consider having it a face to face. That's what we
And Google, and let's come up with
We'll talk about that.
The recommendations that Liz presented, work with those. Good things have been added in addition, but just to not kind of lose the string of what she presented. When people get with that, reasons get with that.
And compliments from certainly to all the work that's been done, because we have been asking and asking, so thank you, Liz.
This is good. Okay, so we'll just talk about work meeting and really hustle down and eat lunch with the students.
It's here on this floor.
Oh, it's right here. It's right over that way, but go sit with the student, especially if they don't have to set it by
us. Let the student check out. Dan, what's going on?
Well, it was a false alarm.
Oh, I love that. Thank you. That's what you're doing today.
She was with partners with
Calvin. Oh, training. Yeah, that's all the news from the staff.
Exactly.
So.
All of it.
So I went out there and I'm like, no, I don't need to be here.
Oh, that's so great. That's the best possible thing that could happen.
But you need to be in that conversation.
Perhaps a little bit.